Hi, everyone. Welcome to another episode of Hashing Out the Law. I'm your host, Arash Hashemi. On this episode, I'm very excited to have basically a superstar in the field of law, Mr. James Brosnahan. I've been practicing that. I hope I got it right. How you doing, sir?
I'm fine. Thank you. Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
It's a pleasure to have you on. I didn't want to take a lot of time and introduce you with all your accolades, but I wanted you to talk about them. I know you've been practicing for over 50 years. You were part of the U.S. Attorney's Office. Could you tell us a little bit about your experience and background? I know you're also a professor at Berkeley. So please tell us, tell the viewers and sure. The listeners about your background.
I'd be happy to. I practiced law for 60 years, actually. And then I became a full-time writer about 3 years ago. And I was a federal prosecutor for 5 years in Phoenix, Arizona, and then in San Francisco, which has been my home ever since. And I tried about 150 trials of all kinds. And I think that's relevant to the book because there's not really a type of case that could be mentioned that I didn't do it. I did all kinds of criminal cases, murder cases and all that, but I also did admiralty or child custody or whatever and enjoyed the diversity of it. We might talk about that. I did get a lot of awards, which, you know, it's nice to get awards, but unless you believe them, if you believe the awards, then you're in deep trouble, as you know, because if you think you're a big shot and you're talking to a jury, that is not the way to go. So I appreciate the awards, but, I was concentrating on trying to convince the jurors. And that's really it. My wife was a judge for 40 years in Alameda County, and we were in law school together. If we have time, we could talk a little bit about that because that's where we met. And there were only 9 women in our class, and there were 500 men. So.
Wow, that's very interesting. I was going to say some of the cases you've done. You already mentioned you've done everything. Under the sun, but you were also part of the Iran-Contra affair trial. You were also part of the city of Oakland, or I'm sorry, the Oakland Raiders versus the city of Oakland. Yeah. So you've done a lot of different things. But let's go back to the beginning, which you were just talking about law school, how you met your wife. You sure. mentioned there was only 9 women in a class of more than 500 men.
There were 9 women. My wife, Carol Simon, was one of the 9 women. Another one of the women was Ruth Bader Ginsburg. And they weren't quite viewed as equal at that time. There were various ways professors had to make it different for them. But anyway, we met and... The way we met is kind of interesting. I hope you'll think so, because there were 6 of us in a house and we thought we should have a cook. And one of my buddies knew that Carol was a very good cook, so invited her over. But before she came, we decided we shouldn't date the cook, because if we date the cook, it'll go badly or it'll go well. You know, we'll lose the cook. And I agreed with everybody, we're not going to date the cook. 3 weeks later, we got engaged.
Wow. So
that's what the law students say when I tell them that. That's exactly what they said. And and 3 weeks after that, we got married.
So let me ask you this. You guys agreed you're not going to date the cook.
Yeah.
And then 3 weeks later, you're engaged to the cook.
Yeah.
At what point did you decide, you know what, screw this agreement, I'm dating the cook?
About 6 days into the 3 weeks, I took a pie over to Carol. She had made an extra pie for herself. I said, I'll take that over there. So I took it over to her apartment. We talked for 2 hours. And that night I took her to an Irish bar. Brosnan's an Irish name, and I was in Boston, a big Irish family. And I took her to an Irish bar, and we talked. We talked this morning. I just talked to her a minute ago, and we'll be married 65 years in November. Was that a big deal in my life? Yes.
Wow. That is so. The hiring of a cook was a decision that altered your life, and you didn't even realize it.
No, and there's other things too, as you know, because one day you're here, and the next day suddenly there's a whole change.
Right.
And that's also true for clients, to keep the clients in mind too. I've represented some CEOs, and most of the CEOs I represented were the day before I got there, they were at the top of the world. They were in limousines and they were all that. But if they needed me, then they had just suffered a terrible change in their circumstances and under criminal investigation, whatever it might be. And people don't realize, I think, what that's like. And it's in the book, when you go from the top to not so top, and right, what that's like for them, and what lawyers do to try to help them, which is one of the themes in the book.
Right. And we're going to talk about the book, but our conversation, you said something and we glazed over it, but I did notice it, and I wanted to talk about it separately than you dating the cook and who ended up being your wife. You went to school with RGB?
Yes.
Wow.
Yes.
And then you said that at that time, the women were treated differently. They were not considered equal as men in law school. Did the women have to sit in a separate section?
No. They could be together with everybody. One of the professors made one of the nine women sing in class, just made her sing, and she couldn't sing. She was not a good singer. And, you know, the kind of late 1950s attitudes by some males, many males really, towards women. And Carol was part of that. Carol is Jewish, and she suffered some discrimination outside the law school in various ways that I became quite familiar with. But I think that the marriage too related to my law practice, because I was able to identify, for a number of reasons, with people who have been previously excluded from things. And we have a lot of stories about how that would happen sometimes to us, one way or the other. The only Irish discrimination I suffered was in Northern Ireland, where an English woman said to her husband, I wasn't even in the room, we were having dinner at their house, and she said, "The Irish have such good rhythm," she said, "but their eyes are too close together." And I had a potato. You know, potato is a symbol of Irish hunger. You know, we had the hunger in 1845 and 50. And that's the only time I ever suffered any Irish slurs or anything, you know, growing up in Boston, which is where I started.
Well, maybe she considered you an American at that point and didn't think anything about you being Irish.
Yeah. Yeah, but
let's talk about your book. Your book is called Justice at Trial, and it's basically, correct me if I'm wrong, it's like a memoir of your career and all the cases. Tell us, I want to know what inspired you to not just be a writer, but write this book specifically, And what was your favorite part about writing this book?
I will try to identify a favorite part, but there are really are many. I wanted to write a book that gave the reader the excitement and the suspense of all kinds of trials, what that's like to be inside. And although it's a memoir, it's definitely a memoir, but often the heroes are other people, like the clients, for example. I can give you a couple of examples of that if we have time. But the courage of the clients, what judges are like, and how some of them are, most of them are really terrific. They're really good. And I'm not sure the public appreciates that right now in particular. I wanted to simplify the law to make the book good for general readers so that they're taken inside a trial, they see what's happening, they see the suspense of it. But as I went along, I became, and you'll appreciate this, I became fascinated with a question I've thought about for years. Why do lawyers do what they do? And specifically, the criminal lawyers will undertake to represent people who are despised. And I did more than one of those. I know what that's like when the world collapses on you and you are seen as, the client is seen as the personification of bad stuff, whatever it might be in the substance of the case. And I represent a couple of people charged with terrorism. And they weren't guilty of that. But one, this is not in the book, but another one is, and he was accused of making bombs in his house in San Francisco. And it's funny, you may have noticed this. The neighbors always say the same thing. They seem like such nice people.
They do.
But you know, the Chronicle said bombs.
Right.
Bombs in the Ingleside neighborhood, you know. And everybody got nervous and all that. And I tell those stories, what those trials were like, who testified.
And I know you represented a Laotian American citizen who was accused of attempting to overthrow the Laotian government. Am I correct?
Yes, it's not in the book, but since you mentioned it, the federal prosecutor, the evidence federal prosecutor had was that my client is sitting in a hotel room, but he's not on the camera. There was a camera there for whatever reason. And a man is speaking, and the prosecutor thought and told the grand jury that that was my client. But there's two kinds of Laotian language, and he didn't speak the language that was being spoken. And that's the, and so they dismissed the case. They had to, because the prosecutor had inadvertently misled the grand jury. I mean, that's a false statement to the grand jury. You know, that's a problem. I was very nice about it. I just pointed out this problem and they dismissed the case. But
let me ask you this. Has the statute of limitations on that case lapsed, or has double jeopardy attached to that case?
But I said both. Long okay. ago, yeah. I'd say double jeopardy, I'm not sure, but the statute of limitations, long ago.
Okay, let me ask you this now. Did he really try to overthrow the Laotian government?
No, and he didn't. And by the way, he was innocent. And and in my discussions with him, I said something like, you know, they say that you got together with these other people in Fresno, you know, and you, he said, we had the might of the U.S. government behind us. He had served with the U.S. government, and his job was to go in the jungle and retrieve American flyers if they were alive, or if they were not. I mean, he was totally loyal to the American government. And
this
he
was
said,
this was during the Vietnam War era, correct?
Yeah, you're right, exactly. And Cambodia was trying to retain its, they had a king, and they were anti-communist. And they were trying to assist the U.S. government in all that. But he said, we couldn't overthrow Vietnam with the might of the United States government behind us. How are we going to do that from Fresno with, 10 people?
Right.
And to say he was sincere is putting it mildly.
Okay. I know you said that particular case is not in the book. What is in the book that really stands out to you as, I don't want to say your favorite, but one of the most interesting cases you worked on?
I think the one that I would mention is an investigation that I was asked to do with a New York civil rights group. There were three of us, and we went over to Northern Ireland during the Troubles. The Troubles lasted 25 years. It was an open revolution with the Catholics on one side and the Protestants on another, in a way that you wouldn't believe if I told you how segregated, beyond segregation.
I actually went to Northern Ireland 3 years ago.
Did you?
Yeah, this is after the Troubles. But I did see how they had the gates and the walls around some neighborhoods where
yeah.
Protestants and the Catholics, they would have a gate, and one side of the street is the Catholics, and one side of the street is the Protestants, and the gates have barbed wire. It was insane. When I went there, obviously all this had ended, but those gates were still there. So I know what you're talking about
It would be like all the Protestants have to live in Glendale for their own safety, and all the Catholics live in Long Beach. It's like the American mind, my mind, couldn't grasp this separation that goes back to Henry VIII when he created a new religion. But that case, we investigated two murders of two lawyers. They were great lawyers. You would have liked these people. I never met them, of course, but I interviewed everybody. We solved one of the murders and notified the British government that we knew, we had the two names of the shooters who shot a man named Patrick Finucane, who was a great civil liberties lawyer, had won many cases in the international court and had embarrassed the British government because what they did. And the police were in on the murders. And we saw that the British government did nothing. Some years later, one of them was actually indicted, and they had lost some evidence of something. They lost it for 20 years. And Rosemary Nelson was one of a new wave of women in Northern Ireland, lawyers, a wonderful lawyer, and developed a good practice. She had her own practice, came to the United Nations, testified about police involvement, testified before Congress, and was about to come over to the United Nations again to give testimony about police involvement in shootings of people. And she got in her car to go down to her office. And when she got to the stop sign, she hit the brake, and the bomb, which was under her, went off, and she was gone. So we investigated those, and that whole story is there. Why is it particularly hitting in my case? Because it's Irish, and because my great grandparents came over during the Hunger. Six of the eight came over and lived in a segregated part of Boston. Went through all that early stuff. Yeah.
So it was sort of like personal to you.
It became very personal, as you have to watch that because you. you're trying to make objective judgments about something. But I understood, you know, some people sign up and they get the family history and all that. I was walking those streets in Belfast, understanding what my parents went through. The Ford Motor Company, which is a plant that made automobiles, had one Catholic working for them, the Ford Motor Company. And the discrimination, 90% of the government employees were Protestant.
Right.
It was, well,
Ford, yeah. And Ford himself was known to be a big, what's the right word? A big selective, he was selective on who he favored. Let's put it that way.
Well, he was anti-Semitic.
He was a big anti-Semite, but that's a whole different. Go ahead.
But he was also a Catholic, is, you know, is the very beginning of the Ford Motor Company.
Now, how did you end up in Northern Ireland on this case? I know that, you know, it had to do with family history, but how did you end up getting chosen or volunteered to be one of the people who's on this case?
My phone rang. It was a civil rights lawyer from New York. He knew that I had represented a man who was from Northern Ireland in a murder case, and he had escaped from the Mays prison. And that's not in the book, by the way, that case. But he knew that I had done, I had already investigated a different murder in Northern Ireland, and said, would you be interested in going over? And I thought about it for half a second, and I said I would. So that's how it happened. And then the three of us went over, interviewed everybody about the two murders, including my favorite, I just want to mention this. We went in and talked to the chief of police, who's known as the head of the Royal Ulster Constabulary, Ronnie Flanagan. And we had done our homework, and we just about accused him of having a police department that was implicated in these murders. It was quite
What was his reaction to that?
His reaction was, he did this three times. He got up, thanked us for coming. Somehow, you know, being an American gave us some kind of protective something or other, and thanked us for coming. We just sat there. We didn't get out of our chairs. And we kept talking to him about his budget. And he had a very small amount of money for the investigation of murders. There's no question but that some police officers were implicated in these and other murders. So
it's very interesting and mind blowing. How long now? I'm assuming this was while you were married, right?
Oh yeah.
So was your wife with you, or
no, no, no? She didn't come, but she made me swear that I would be careful and wouldn't go anywhere without people, and you know, and all. And I said that's right. So I landed on a Sunday afternoon in Belfast and went to the hotel. I checked in, walked out, and walked directly into what I thought was a hostel area, only to find that it was a Catholic area. So there wasn't any risk. But my compulsion to know about Ireland by reading lots of books over all the years is been enriching to me. The Irish heritage with me, for whatever reason, has been a gift that I got.
That's great. That's I'm glad to hear that, because a lot of people don't remember their own history, and I think people who don't know their own history have a problem looking into the future. But let's talk about, I do have a question about this. How did you survive without your wife's cooking in Northern Ireland?
You know, it's ironic. On the earlier trip, we ate at 11 restaurants, and 10 of them were as good as what you might enjoy in, you know, some of the better restaurants in Los Angeles or wherever you might be. What are they doing here? And that was the middle of the troubles. People are getting shot and all that. Why aren't they in Hawaii, you know, specializing in seafood or something? But the food was excellent.
That's great. We talked about your book. I want to know, besides your book, besides this book, what other books have you written, or are you working on any right now?
Both. In the 70s, I wrote a book called The California Trial, and it was designed for practicing lawyers, and you could take it to court. And it would have, it had lots of cases, current cases at that time. It took me 1,000 hours to write it, and I was trying cases in the middle of it all, but I got it done. And it, if I may say, it was a popular book. There were a lot of people that bought it. We sold about 3,000 copies, something like that. And I got letters for a long time about people thanking me for writing. That was nice. The next trial that I'm book that I'm working on right now is a history of trial, which has always fascinated me. I mean, I started being interested just to figure out what is a trial lawyer supposed to do. I mean, what? How do we handle this and learn more about cross examination and all that? But this book will be about 200 pages. It starts with Socrates' trial. And I worked very hard already on it in terms of the cultural setting of these trials. And I've got the development of various things. I've got civil rights cases as an example. I've got trials where the real issue was the difference of the defendants, the Zach Zut trial in the 1940s, where a group of Hispanic young men, I think there were 39 of them, was a large number, were put on trial, mostly because who they were, not what they did.
The Zut Suit trials in Los Angeles, that's the one?
Yeah, in the book.
Yeah, it's well known locally. I'm a big history buff, so I'm looking forward to that book, History of Trial. That's two things I love, trials and history. So I look forward to that book. Unfortunately, we're a little bit short on time. We're running out of time. I would like to keep you all day and pick your brain. But where can we get your books? I know that you have your own website. By the way, we're going to include the link to your website on the description of the podcast, so everybody can visit it. But could you tell us what your website is and if your book is available anywhere else, please?
Yeah, well, two things. I'm on LinkedIn and under my name, Jim Brosnahan, and the book is referred to there. It's available, of course, at Amazon and Barnes & Noble and all these, and you can order it in any bookstore in the United States. And then I'm at Jim J. Brosnahan, BrosNahan.com. And that's my website, and you can order it there as well. I look forward. I'm going around the country, and probably will appear in a number of places before the end of the year, and enjoying it. I'm also talking to law students, which is awful lot of fun.
By the way, are you still teaching?
No, I taught for 10 years at Berkeley Law. Well, I am teaching. On LinkedIn, I started about 4 weeks ago with a series on how to improve your voice, not just for lawyers, but for anybody. And because I taught voice to lawyers and law students for about 35 years and still doing it. I still go over to Berkeley once a year and teach voice, among other things. And I think you would be surprised at how many practicing lawyers and law students are concerned about their voice at some level, from slight to pretty serious. And here they are appearing in court and talking, and they've never had voice training.
Yeah, a lot of people don't like their own voice. I'm surprised at the number of people who go to law school, pass the bar, practice law, and never want to go to court. That's a whole different topic with me. But again, we're going to include the links to your website, to your LinkedIn, and everything in the description, so our listeners and viewers can look it up, look at your series, get a hold of your book. I'm honored and privileged to have you on. It was a great discussion. Hopefully I can have you back on when your new book comes out and when you're done touring, and we can talk about more of your war stories.
Yeah, when we do that, you'll be reminded that Socrates was the greatest pain in the whatever that any client ever was. And I'll tell you that story if I come back.
I heard Socrates had a wife who whined a lot, and he used her as an inspiration to remember the good things rather than the bad things. Or did I get my philosophers wrong?
No, I'm sure you don't. But he irritated all the politicians because he kept asking questions. And as you know from current events, they can't stand that.
That's true. Okay. It was a pleasure again. Hope to have you on, and good luck.
Thanks very much. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.